Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
From homemade donuts that began with missionaries more than 100 years ago, to canned salmon loaf from the 1930s, to tang pie from the mid-century, every Alaska recipe tells a story about our history. A group of women from Alaska's publishing world are on the hunt for important Alaska recipes and their backstories as they build a cookbook that charts the last few centuries of Alaska's culture through food. Maybe you have one to share. We discuss what they've collected so far and what they're looking for today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Julia O'Malley in for Lori Townsend. There's more to recipes than whether they are good or bad. The little cards in Grandma's recipe books carry clues about history. They tell us which foods were available and which foods weren't, show us the influence of economic forces like the oil boom, and give us a peek into women's lives. Today, I'm joined by three culinary researchers and longtime Alaskans who are collecting important recipes and the human stories behind them for a cookbook project called Around the Alaskan Table. Angela Liebal owns Tidal Wave Books. Karen Sobolewski is a writer and editor. And Lori Evans-Deneen is a freelance writer and editor with a background in cultural education. All right, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Can you all tell us a little bit more about who you are and also how you came to be involved in this project? Want to start with us?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Karen Sobolewski. I'm a lifelong Alaskan from the age of 7 days. That in itself is a story. For the last 25 years, I've been a sales representative for major Alaskan book publishers and traveled the state. And along the way, about 10, 12 years ago, an idea started percolating about people have unique stories. What could we do to make those stories augment them with a little bit of spice? So I thought, well, we'll pair stories, family stories, how you got to Alaska, why you stayed, or if you were born here, what your story was, because everyone has one, and then give us a recipe that your family maybe always made for a holiday or a special occasion. So I drafted two of my friends, and I think they're still glad they signed on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Angela.
Yeah, I'm Angela Liebal, and as Julia said, I'm the business owner of Tidal Wave Books, and that's how I met Karen many years ago as a sales rep and bookish friend with many common interests, and I was so pleased that she asked me to participate. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I was not here at 7 days old, but shortly after. Raised a family and always had an interest in food and sharing food cultures around the kitchen table. And the stories that we share as we bring in new family members or friends and maybe people visiting outside of Alaska and then having them stick around, yeah, as a part of that circle.
Karen?
And I'm Lori Evans-Deneen. And
Lori, thank you. Sorry. Rookie mistake here on Talk of Alaska. Okay, go ahead.
Lori Evans-Deneen, and I moved here in 92 after I received my MFA from the University of Oregon in poetry. So where I thought I might be doing poetry, I'm doing other things, such as grant writing for different organizations around the community, as well as editing and doing some work with authors in the state, working with Epicenter Press as the Alaska representative, helping authors bring their works to life. And I think, you know, coming from the Midwest, originally, my family were Southside Chicago in its Italian-Irish neighborhoods, and everything was available. I don't ever remember not being able to get a vegetable or whatever that I might need. So when I moved to Alaska, I was quite astounded about, and this is 1992, not even that long ago, but long enough, obviously, but the quality of vegetables and things that have certainly come a long way mm-hmm. in my time here. But when I think about that whole cooking factor, we do. I brought my mother's recipe box. I was the inheritor of her cookbook and recipe box. And my family regularly calls me for recipe things that they maybe forgot or need extra help on or whatever. But we all come with that story of why we're here and why we stayed, too. Mm-hmm. And then what did we bring from our home cultures, that sort of comfort food, if you will, or favorite recipe? And we have been hearing some amazing stories. I feel like in a lot of ways, the book is about the stories. Mm-hmm. And really, that's the meat of it. And then the recipes are kind of like that gravy, that juice that flows out of that amazing story.
Whoa. Just got good food metaphor. Sometimes when, you know, I sort of think about it like food is a kind of a carrier molecule for like other things. So mm-hmm. food's always carrying identity, memory, resistance, mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of things that aren't even really about food, which leads us to also wonder, does it matter if recipes are good or bad? We'll get to that later. Do you all want to... I think, tell me, is it Lori that has written a mission statement? But do you want to talk? You don't have to actually read it, but do you want to sort of say a little bit more about how,
sure,
what that says?
I think when Karen was first talking about the book, it really made me ponder that whole home culture. I worked a lot in various cultural aspects in the state. And there's always sort of the mainstream culture, the home culture, the school culture, you know, different cultures we move in and out of daily. And so when I thought about that idea of like the recipe and the home culture and what we bring with us, when we move new places, sometimes we want to leave everything behind. But oftentimes we bring a lot more with us than we realize that is from who we really are, mm-hmm. our home culture. And so when we talk about Alaska, we think about it as, you know, this nomadic lifestyle. And whether it's an indigenous or, you know, you came up with the military or for work in the oil patch, all of those, we all brought something with us. And I think that's the thing that, going back in our history, but now we're in these new generations and a lot of our recipes have certainly been handed down mm-hmm. and our younger generations have put their mark on them. And mm-hmm. so it's kind of like that Japanese fusion I hear about, or even there's indigenous fusion now. Mm-hmm. There's some cool stuff going on out there. And so I think what we're looking for is... Alaskans coming together and sharing their stories. And so we have this sort of idea of like, come, join us at the table.
Tell us who you are. Mm-hmm. Tell us your story, because we really want to know yeah. what it is. Mm-hmm. And from that, we've heard some amazing stories. We really have.
This gets to my next question, which was there really a recipe for a cake that was being baked during the 1964 earthquake yeah. in your repertoire?
Yes. Interesting that you should ask, because yes, there was. I have it right here. The original recipe is over 100 years old, so it's traveled with the family for a long time, and the use of a box cake mix modernized the recipe in the 1950s. And this came from a large family of 11 children, and so it was inexpensive to make, and everybody loved it. And it was, you know, the Jell-O cakes where you poke the holes in the top, you know, okay.
It's Jell-O poke cake?
Yes, mm-hmm. very very similar to this, in that you baked a yellow cake in a 9x13 pan, and then after you've harvested your 4 cups of wild Alaskan blueberries and mixed them with sugar, then you pour them over the cake and chill it. And
you mix them with sugar on the stove, or?
You know, I don't have the answer to that question yeah. yet, but I think, I hope so.
Otherwise, you could do it the other way, yeah. where they sort of macerate like
yeah,
that.
Just puncture the top of the cake with fork so the juice of the berries will soak in. So I'm not entirely sure, but I'll go back and ask. And then you pour them over the cake, and then you slather it in 7-minute frosting.
Yes, yes, yes. This is like an important cake that you're describing. Mm-hmm. I've heard it all over rural Alaska. It's made with Jell-O and berries and then Cool Whip.
This doesn't have Jell-O in it. And then you preserve a few of the berries to sprinkle over the top to make it look pretty. So, okay, back to the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
March 27th. 1964 at 5:36 p.m. as we all clearly remember, those of us that were there. It was one of the boy's ninth birthday, and so the cake was in baking in the oven when the earthquake struck, and the electricity went out shortly thereafter. So every mother would, I'm sure, jump to the occasion to preserve the birthday. So she started a fire in the fireplace to finish baking the cake, which apparently worked.
Well,
the bottom of the cake was black, but once you put enough 7-minute frosting on the top of it, it really didn't matter. And, you know, everyone was able to enjoy birthday cake.
There you go. And where was this?
In Anchorage.
In Anchorage.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Are there any other stories that come to mind that you have collected that you wanted to share? Yeah.
I recently got one from someone who manages Denali Base Camp. And that's kind of a job that you don't really think about. Here in Alaska, as Alaskans, we know that tourism is so critical in the summer, and there's all these people coming from all over the world. And Denali is that destination for that type of adventure. And someone's got to manage that camp, all those people coming and going and flowing through. Anyway, so the recipe that I was given came with this amazing story about her history as the base camp manager, but also the recipe was called the Kahiltna Fog, and it starts with a handful of snow.
Okay.
And it's a three-ingredient recipe.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We were going to make some for you this morning, but we couldn't find
sadly,
any snow.
71
wrong,
degrees.
Wrong season.
Wrong season. So, yeah, then you grab your Grey Goose vodka and you grab a cup and you put the snow in the cup and then sprinkle your Grey Goose vodka and then add a splash of Country Time lemonade.
Wow. High level.
Literally.
High level. Again, though, we have that influence of the packaged food, the crystallized concentrated drink mix is like a total thing.
What's lightweight? What can you have there with you? What's available to you? And she said, if you have it, add a slice of lime.
Somehow.
A signature cocktail.
That, that you get. I hope there's some of the bartenders listening to this program right now. I can see this really snow coming in as a fun novelty.
Yeah.
Any other things that come into mind?
I would like to share, I've got a couple in mind, but I'm going to kind of go with the Duke Russell story. He's a local artist, Duke Russell, and he shared with us that his family traveled a lot in his younger days, and at 18 he stayed. But he, as you know, he's an artist, but he fell into sort of that hippie groove and that idea of nurturing one another and taking care of each other. And somewhere along the way in his travels, he came up with what's called the French laundromat. Pinto beans with rice pilaf.
Okay.
And so if you're following Duke these days, he's doing these great community feasts where he's feeding the hungry in our communities, which is an amazing endeavor. And so he has shared with us not only that incredible story, and there's more to it. You have to read the book. But there's this idea of you know, it serves 200. So when we think about, you know, camp and serving large quantities, but his is serving the community, and it's a beautiful story. So he has taken this idea of these community feasts. I think he does a couple of summer or maybe a season where he's bringing people together, and you can bring your things. But it's this very sort of, I'm going to say, healthy dish, if you will, but at the same time filling and to serve for, you know, the community folks that need it. And it's just a really cool story that someone is giving back to the community through food, and I love it.
And we see, like, there, like, this food theme in Alaska's cooking culture, which is that the commissary kitchen, the sort of large-scale feeding of people, which goes back basically along with all the resource development that has occurred over the last, you know, 150 years. So that's super cool. We have our first caller.
Hooray!
Everyone's excited. Dennis, are you there? Dennis from Juneau is calling.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. What do you have to tell us about?
Well, you know, I'm fortunate that I inherited the family cookbooks.
Awesome.
My mom's, my grandmother's, and my great-grandmother, who came to Alaska in 1916. and then left and moved later. But my grandmother collected all these various little booklets that came with canned foods and things.
Yeah.
But, of course, she canned her own salmon, like most Alaskans did back in those days. And she had this recipe for salmon stuffed peppers from Libby McNeil and Libby.
What year?
And I have been using it ever since, probably from the, I would say, the late 30s, early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little brochure. I discovered that it works great for a bachelor because I can make a batch of them. I just take one of those Costco bags with six peppers in it.
Yeah.
Cut the tops off, chop the tops up, make my salmon loaf mixture with peppers in it, and then roast them in a water bath. And then I'll eat one, and I'll go ahead and seal a meal the rest of them, one by one. And then when I want one for dinner, all I have to do is poke a couple holes in the bag of frozen pepper and stick it in the microwave.
Brilliant.
And I've got a good dinner in a few minutes.
That's great.
Good tips from Dennis. So that salmon loaf is such a significant historic recipe. It was, I think, one of the Bristol Bay canneries that introduced canned salmon to the American market at the World's Fair in 19, gonna forget, maybe. I will, at least 100 years ago, let's go there.
Yeah.
It's like the oldest salmon recipe, you know, that we have. And also it was sort of the first way that, you know, women were being asked to cook salmon as a cheaper alternative to, you know, beef mm-hmm. at that time. So what else?
Well, I have one for Denali and Chili Rellenos.
Mm-hmm.
This came to me from a friend who was born in California. We know many, many, many people. Most of us immigrated from somewhere. And she came to Alaska in 82, noticed a small ad in her local paper for jobs in Alaska. And so she was ready for an adventure, and she was a job as a maid in Denali. She didn't care, so she got there. And they didn't make her a maid. They put her in the gift shop. So 43 years, three kids and two grandchildren later, she still has a gift shop. She and her husband have owned several gift shops at Denali, and she still owns one. Anyway, her dad was a worked for a gypsum mining company in Southern California, a town which no longer exists but would have been a company town. And they went to a gathering of different families, you know, what we might call a potluck, and tasted these chili rellenos that were made by one of the women that brought the dish. And so Karen's mom got the recipe, and we're going to share it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these recipes came from outside, and so we just wanted to tell, like I said, it's telling people stories. Another interesting one we heard from somebody that Lori and I know is from Nome, and her grandfather came to Alaska from Italy following the gold rush.
Mm.
And he would hang big strands of garlic in his cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought this family spaghetti recipe with him. It's never been written down, so it's just been passed down orally mm-hmm. all these years. But Cindy's going to help us write something down. And so she starts off with a cast iron fry pan, a bear tack, and this recipe. I'm like, oh. So the cast iron pan deflected the bear in some fashion as they were getting ready to make the spaghetti sauce, and they were browning moose meat. And of course, we know that sometimes it's hamburger, and sometimes now it's ground turkey, and sometimes it's ground chicken.
Yeah.
So it's all of these things that have interesting origins for families. And so through the generations, it's now in the third or fourth generation about this one recipe and the story about the bear that was also part of the story that day.
Sounds a little bit like a Looney Tunes scenario.
Yeah, it does sound like
there's an Acme product.
Sounds exciting.
How are you finding these recipes and families? How are you, you know, finding these people?
We've done a couple waves of outreach, sort of word of mouth to people that we know, that we suspect have a really good story to tell, or that we know because we've maybe heard it before. And then we've also done some community outreach. We've been to the Dome on the community walk days and set up a table and say, hey, how long have you lived in Alaska?
Yeah. What brought you to Alaska?
How long have you here? We've heard some really interesting stories along that line, too, where one woman had told us, she's like, well, I was on a layover on my way to Australia.
Kind of shake your head on that one. But yeah. Oh,
okay. Did you ever make it to Australia?
No.
I've been here ever since.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
And another gentleman who is in the 70s and you sound like probably a hippie because there was a VW van involved
yes.
and a trip from California going to Mexico.
Yes.
When he heard about the Northern Lights, so he turned around and decided he'd go to Vancouver, BC. But then when he got there and saw them, he thought, yeah, but I think they're better in Whitehorse. So he drove on up to Whitehorse, left his van there, hitched a ride to Anchorage,
yes.
went back to get the van, spent the rest of his life in Anchorage as a teacher. And I said, did you ever make it to Mexico? No. So those folks, as interesting as those stories are, and we hope they're listening, we'd like to have the recipe that goes with the story.
That's the thing is, like, some people got crazy stories, but yeah. how do you connect food
yes.
to it? I wanted to sort of just, you know, talk a little bit about significant recipes through the last sense contact
mm-hmm.
And just see what you have all, if you've collected anything about these sorts of things. And one like real milepost there is fish pie, which mm-hmm. comes from the Russian era. And so have you heard much about it? Can we talk about fish pie a little bit?
The recipe the author gave me her dad's salmon recipe because he'd been a fisherman, but she mentioned it in the story about how there in Kodiak there was always kind of an ongoing contest as who could make the best one. So we will track that down
mm-hmm.
Because that did come up and it's of interest to us to know more. I do have Lily's working on fish head soup.
Oh, very mm-hmm. good. Okay.
Okay, that's important. So that would be an indigenous.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We do want indigenous recipes. We want hunter-gatherer. We want, we have other folks that we know. We've kind of put our fingers out into people we know and people that they know. And so what we've gotten has come through that vehicle. And now we're hoping that people that are listening today will go, oh, you know, I think I'd like to share my story. And a family recipe that we've all enjoyed. And
mm-hmm.
This is going to be a book for everybody. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Not?
Well, that's even at work, we were talking about berries because it's berry season.
Yes.
We're all out picking all kind of berries. And I was talking about a blueberry crisp that I made. And my coworker, I work at Chulista Education and Culture, was talking about the agudok that she's going to make with her berries.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, we should have an agudok recipe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I bet sure. we could get a couple of good ones. Pretty basic, but nonetheless, I think it needs to have a place because it is definitely, I am sure I'm going to get a good story with it as well, her
mm-hmm.
family background and different things. But also, just it's a staple in rural Alaska and probably on a lot of Anchorage tables as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I asked a friend of mine last night about she had a good fish egg recipe. And she said, well, I normally just boil them and then eat them. And I went, do you add salt?
she said,
not you could. Yeah. And I went, okay. I don't quite know. It sounds simple. But I'm sure I'll talk to her more about that. So we do, we've reached out where we can and we're anxious to hear about people and how they may have changed the recipes over the years too. You know, like the blueberry cake, it's made some iterations
sure.
over time.
Oh, Maddie's hooking me up in the booth. It's the 1904 World's Fair.
Ah, very good.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maddie.
Yeah, it's the Alaska Packers Association. I've actually written about this, but then promptly forgot. But that was when we introduced canned salmon to, when Alaska introduced canned salmon to American housewives.
Can I say something
yeah.
on that, though? So growing up in Chicago, I lived on canned salmon.
Yeah.
Salmon patties, as my mother
oh,
would call
yeah.
them. And
yeah.
I thought they were the most amazing thing. I'm going to sound really weird when I say when I moved here and had fresh salmon cakes. Whoa. What a difference.
I think people feel that way about most people eat Atlantic farm salmon. Yeah. I think they feel like the salmon here is weird because it tastes more like fish.
Right. You know? Yeah. I have relatives back home. When I can my salmon, they don't want it. It tastes too fishy. And I'm like, what does that mean? But that being said, we do a killer canned salmon. So,
and tinned fish is having this kind of
they started calling it tinned fish, and now it's all the stuff. And I'm like, whatever, y'all. Like,
it's been around forever. Last time I was in Homer, I was at one of the shops, and it was just like this wall. And the packaging is so beautiful, and there's like amazing artwork on it. And it's just, I wanted to buy it all, you know. And I did buy a couple, but it's just so neat to see that our Alaska fish is kind of having this little moment.
Well, mm-hmm. It's become more and more precious over time.
Sure, you know, for sure.
Because there is actually less of it than there used to be.
It's not a guaranteed resource, yeah.
No. I was going to ask, okay, so the next thing I wanted to kind of pick your brains about was is sourdough. Mm-hmm. You know, we know it came to Alaska during the gold rush and came from, and it was, you know, people are making it in California, and that's where they got the idea. But what are you hearing about sourdough much? Are you hearing much about it?
No, although I've been promised two recipes, but I have yet to see them. If you're listening.
Yeah, I've heard,
you know who you are.
I know who to talk to about Dick Pronecki's.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll get a hold of Lisa and see, push her a little harder on, because she made, she had Babe Woolsworth, and so she just chronicled when she was making her golden spoon, which was a starter.
So spoon we thought dipped in a starter.
Yeah, we thought we'd get a lot of that. And the other thing, we thought we'd get 101 rhubarb recipes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we've gotten two.
Oh,
which is good. I think we should talk a minute about Spam and the importance.
For sure. Before we do that, we have to go to a break. When we come back, more about Spam. And also, if you're out there listening, can you give us some of your sourdough stories? All right. Just a minute when we come back. Okay, so this is awesome. Guess what? We asked the universe, and we have manifested a sourdough pancake caller.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Wonderful. Marion, welcome. Tell us what you have to say about sourdough pancakes.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention, I'm newer to Alaska, but my husband's been here for several generations and, you know, lots of hardy men owning businesses and building railroads and all that. And they've passed down a sourdough culture that my husband was gifted a couple years ago by his dad. And so we've been keeping that going. And my favorite part of having this is that when the pancakes are made, and he always makes them, that is for him tasting the exact same pancake, almost the literal same pancake that he had as a kid when his grandfather would cook them. And so he can share this meal kind of across generations that has the same exact kind of like flavor and mouthfeel and the tanginess and everything.
That's beautiful.
Time travel.
I love that.
Yeah, time travel in a pancake.
We should have that recipe sent in to us, and you can find that on our website at Around the Alaska Table, around the AKTable.com. If you want to share that with us, Marion.
And we'll go ahead and post that on our, when we put the show up as well.
I'll ask his permission.
Perfect.
Exactly.
Because I have been gifted my mother-in-law's sourdough, which is from 1996. I'm sure it goes back farther than that, but because I moved here in 96, I don't have her full story. But I have her sourdough waffle recipe that she has made forever. Yeah. And it was always on Mother's Day we'd get together, and that was what she made. And then she had a B&B, and that's what she served her guests every day. It's the sourdough waffles. And it is, I get it with the pancakes. It is exactly and the most amazing, the flavor, the richness of that sourdough.
This is reminding me of the Alaska Sourdough Cookbook.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you actually read the stories in there? Because they are somewhat off color if we are going to be
It's funny. I haven't reread it.
I kind of think the recipes are bad. I'm going to be honest.
I love it. Homework.
But the thing that's interesting is the use of sourdough has changed over time. So it was used mostly for its acidity, and it was mixed with they called it saltpeter, but it's like baking soda.
Yeah.
To rise things and kind of give them flavor. And it's very different than we use sourdough now, which is like a leavener.
Mm-hmm.
But the sourdough, I think, and I'm making this up because I don't know, but I think that the sourdough pancake, which is basically like the early pancake, was just saltpeter and sourdough starter, so sourdough and water and then, like, you know, baking soda.
Super tangy.
I think that goes back, like, as I think that's the first thing that was ever made, right?
With like
that,
a griddle cake.
Like a griddle cake. Bread. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, how much have you all looked at Alaska's historic cookbooks? Have you looked at them much?
We have a little bit.
We all own some, and then we send pictures back and forth, and in our meetings we get together and we kind of look at them, and we've had offers of
people always
lending.
Oh, they always trying to give them to you.
Yeah,
you have to watch it.
Yeah, exactly. But we're wanting not just to, like, photocopy an existing recipe out of a historic cookbook. We want the story, and then how maybe a recipe has evolved and changed over time and has been incorporated into a family and been made slightly unique. Everyone has a sourdough pancake recipe or a waffle recipe, but then if you really start looking into the actual ingredients and the measurements, I bet they're all just a little bit different. And why are they different? And how were they changed over time by a family? That's fascinating to us.
I wanted to talk about this thing that I have noticed, you know, studying Alaska's recipes, mostly written cookbook recipes over time, which is this feeling of longing. Mm-hmm. I think longing is something that, you know, and we've touched on it a little bit, but that idea of wanting something that you can't quite have, mm-hmm. or missing something far away, and how food carries that vibe, as the kids say, mm-hmm. here in a way that it's, like, different than other places because we're so far. And even if you're from rural Alaska and you're longing for the food yeah. from home, you know, you're kind of far in that case. But I don't know if that theme has come up much, or if that's something
sure.
that you have heard much about.
Well, I grew up in Anchorage, and so in the 50s and 60s, fresh fruit or fresh vegetables were a rarity. So I remember my mother attempts at salads. And you may have some memories.
Quotes.
Air quotes.
Salads. Was there Jell-O in there?
No, actually it was not Jell-O. She would take a lettuce leaf, always had a lettuce leaf.
Yes.
And green beans, cold green beans out of the can.
Oh, yes, can. Yep.
Shredded carrot.
Nice.
Always and forever a dollop of mayonnaise and paprika on top.
Paprika on top.
Beautiful.
Paprika's, like, it was really hot
yeah.
as, like, a garnish.
It was
garnish.
Everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, or it could be a half a canned pear on a lettuce leaf. Maybe not mayonnaise, but. You know, a little bit of whipping
cheese.
Cream or cottage cheese. Yeah. And so, you know, and now you think, you know, there's almost an endless array of lettuce at the farmer's market yeah. or at the grocery store. So you don't
backyard.
Have, and there's no dearth of lettuce. And so it's hard when you think back and, you know, those are kind of precious memories for me. And I don't know that I would necessarily want to recreate them, but I do share the stories with my children because I don't think, unless you lived here, you really understood that you had to crack your eggs into a cup before you made whatever.
Put them in the bowl.
Yeah, before you're going to put them in the bowl.
Boat eggs, they'd be
yeah.
stinky. Mm-hmm.
And how milk could get, now my mother's word was ticky.
Ticky? Mm.
Oh. Just before it turned?
Yeah.
You can still drink it, but it's ticky.
Or the powdered milk.
Oh, God.
There's a lot of deep Alaska powder milk
yeah.
trauma. Okay, we got a bunch of emails here.
Great.
So one, we'll start here with, we've got David from Fairbanks, and he says, some years ago, Sourdough Sam's Cafe in Fairbanks caught fire, and it was reported that after it was safely evacuated, someone ran back to save the sourdough. The restaurant was able to continue serving the same sourdough after rebuilding. They have since shut down, but they are an important part of Fairbanks history.
I've eaten there many times.
Yeah. Oh, man. And then we have Rebecca Poulsen, and she's writing about whether we're talking about native foods, and we should get onto that. We have
yes.
talked about, they have been talking about agoutik and preserved salmon eggs, but predating all of these sort of, a lot of the recipes we're talking about are kitschy mid-century.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the ways of cooking that predate contact are fermentation,
yes.
smoke, salt, wind for drying.
Yes.
And so she says, maybe I missed this, but are they including native foods like how to prepare stink eggs or ways to prepare and enjoy herring eggs, smoked salmon, preserve roots, etc.?
We're absolutely looking for those recipes and stories that go along with it. I have had somebody talk to me about the delicacy of beaver paw.
Whoa.
And how that's reserved for elders as a special acknowledgement gift.
A fermented beaver paw?
Well, the way she was talking about it being prepared was that it was being boiled, but it took a long time. And she had spent the previous day doing that with a friend. And I said, I'd love to hear more about that. And she's, I would say, in her 70s. She said, I don't love it, but it's such an important dish, and it's given to honor the elders as a delicacy. And I said, we would love to hear all about that. So I'm hoping that she puts pen to paper or emails us that, because it's so important to know about those kinds of traditions and acknowledgement and respect of the elders that came before.
We have, this is one of my favorite historic cookbooks, but we have a writer talking about the Shishmaref Day School cookbook. It's like a tiny little one. Uh-huh. It's very special. You may have seen it come through Tidal Wave. It's worth a bunch of money now, I think.
Yeah.
It says, I would love to gift it to someone who's interested in collecting older Alaska cookbooks. Any idea? I have no history on the book, but acquired it from a friend who found it out of state. This is Terry Patton writing. Terry, that is a kind of a historic artifact, and actually those are very much in demand and they're very delicate. But what's beautiful is it's basically like the children, and you probably, maybe you've all seen this one, but it's red, I think, with a little drawing on the front, but it's the children of the school asking the elders how to prepare food. And it's very simple, you know, boiling is pretty much the only kind of cooking method, but lots of wind and smoke and salt and fermentation, you know, comes up. So that's a super special thing, Terry. Hold on to that or sell it on eBay maybe or contact these guys.
Yeah, gift it to the museum. Yeah,
the museum has one.
Send us a message on our website.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and if putting pen to paper is too daunting, we are happy to call people in and interview them.
We've
done a lot of that too.
We got another caller.
Okay.
This is our third caller. Heating up in here. This is John and Homer. What do you have to say about your old cookbook recommendation?
Well, my favorite cookbook was published in 1978 by the Nanilchik Homemakers Association.
Oh, this is a good cookbook.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad you found it, but it's interesting because the recipes are so basic and creative for the old times. And it has some many interesting recipes, but I'll just name a few. There's a pickled hot dog.
Ooh.
Okay.
Oh, my.
All right. Okay.
You can preserve that even more.
Yeah. I don't know. It may outlive us all.
There's a bourbon hot dog.
We are messing with the hot dogs up here. Okay.
Those are on pages 1 and 3. And then there's an easy stew. There's a mock ham loaf. There's something called moose birds, which I've not tried.
Moose
there's
birds?
Called, moose birds, yeah.
Is there
something called Russian baba? I don't know what that is.
Is that a cake? We'll find out. Someone's going to call in.
Yeah.
Is there a bedarkie casserole in that one? Maybe I'm getting it confused. You know what? That's in the Seldovia one.
I have that one.
Mm-hmm. That's a good cookbook.
I didn't see that one. There are beef oysters.
Beef oysters.
Whatever that is.
So, John, have you made any of those recipes? Are any of those ones that you've tried and liked and...
Oh, yeah.
Have made into your regular rotation?
Well, I don't have a regular rotation, but I am a bachelor, so I appreciate things that are easy.
Sure.
And what you can make with very little. But I did rhubarb bread, which was delicious.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Oh, we're back on rhubarb. Thanks a lot for sharing that, John. Appreciate the tour through the hot dog world. of that cookbook.
And send us a recipe.
I'd say feel free to send us one of your favorites.
I mean, that does get into where we were headed, which is to do with shelf-stable packaged foods that sort of began to enter our sort of food culture just mid-century or a little earlier than that. Mm-hmm. And they play a big role in the recipes that you find in cookbooks. But I wonder, you know, kind of what your experience has been.
I haven't seen a lot of it. Most of it has been pretty...
Well, so one of the recipes that I have, it's a little bit different than that, but it goes from being harvested clams to canned clams, because we have canned clams available now.
Right.
But it's a dish from, it's Arla Sturgalewski, if you recognize her.
I love her. Awesome.
Yep. Bless her. Yeah. So her story, you know, she comes from Washington, and her father was a logger, and she was born on the eve of the Great Depression. So as you can imagine, money was tight. And so as she was moving along, she was always a reader, and she was encouraged to do education, which is kind of how she landed here. But they always clammed because it was an inexpensive way, subsistence, you know, in Washington to get a meal. And so clam patties is a recipe that was given to me by Arliss's daughter-in-law, Carol Sturgalewski. And so she has shared that Arliss passed this down, and Arliss's maiden name is Wright. So it's a Wright family recipe, W-R-I-G-H-T, Wright family recipe that's been handed down. And it's very simple. You know, your 2 cups of ground clams, 2 eggs, rolled crackers, because a lot of...
crackers are hot. We are crackers.
And then you mix it up. If it's a little thick, you add milk. And then you just heap the tablespoons into the fat and fry it. And so, of course, you know, that's like where you take subsistence. And of course, she said these days a lot of people use canned clams because you don't have the time to run down to Ketchumack Bay and catch clams.
We have to go to a break, but let's pick it up when we get back. We'll just take a quick break, and then we'll be back onto rolling things in cracker crumbs in just a minute.
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Julia O'Malley in for Loring Townsend, and I am here with Angela Leeball, Karen Sobolewski, and Lori Evans-Deneen, and we are talking about their project that is researching Alaska's food culture by collecting recipes and stories. Okay, so we have another caller coming in from Homer. Mary Lou wants to talk about fish pie. What's up, Mary Lou?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have, my resource is the Kodiak Fisherman Wives Cookbooks.
Perfect.
I've had for many years. It's a very old cookbook now. I'm sure 30 years plus years. Anyways, I really like their fish pie recipe, which is, I think, Russian-based, and it's leftover salmon, and they layer it with cabbage, and I like rutabaga in it. Rice goes on, it's a double crust. The rice goes on the bottom of the crust, and then you layer your other stuff, salt and pepper, dill, any other veggies you want to throw in there, and then I finish it off with rice on the top and put the double crust on.
Nice.
Putting pats of butter in it. And then, yeah, it's just delicious. It's just a really, you can vary it any way you want.
Do you put eggs in that? Boiled eggs in that?
I'm sorry. Yes, I forgot that. Boiled eggs, slice those up, and those will layer in there also.
Fantastic. That's a cool cookbook. I don't have that one. Thank you, Mary Lou, for sharing about that.
Thank you for your show.
Thank you.
So we were just talking a little bit about, we were talking about this clam recipe. Another aspect in how we cook is our relationship to the wild place, and the abundance of things like clams has really changed over time. So there's a way in which these recipes you're collecting are also kind of a story about changing climate and harvest or over-harvest. And so there's a little bit, you know, in that theme of longing, there's a little bit of, you know, loss in there as well, or nostalgia. It's just interesting to kind of hear you guys talk about that. I'm thinking about that some. So let's talk more about Spam.
Because my mother rolled hers in breadcrumbs or cracker crumbs.
The cracker crumb, it never stopped being a thing. You know, we've got a lot of cracker crumbs made into cakes. We got There is, I really think that crackers plus mayonnaise and fish is like a good, is a hard, it's hard to top. It's, good. Yeah. It's pretty good. I'm not going to lie. I like it. But what do we, well, do we have a Spam recipe?
We don't yet, but I remember she would slice it, roll it, dip it in egg yolk, or dip it in egg, roll it in breadcrumbs or cracker crumbs, and fry it. And you know what? It's quite good.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, and my grandson texted us a picture. They were at Nusagaya, and of all the different kinds of Spam there is, light Spam, jalapeno Spam, zesty Spam. I mean, there must have been 12 different kinds of Spam. So Spam has certainly evolved. And then, of course, we, you know, we can't forget pilot bread.
Yeah. Of course.
Which
of
is
course.
A staple.
Who could forget pilot bread?
Yeah. We couldn't possibly forget
that. I'm kind of drooling over the jalapeno Spam. And now on a pilot bread, I'm like, that sounds like a winner.
I mean, a little mayonnaise.
With a little mayonnaise, although.
If left alone, it might never spoil, like, nothing there. But yeah, no, there's a rainbow of Spam now available. But that actually brings up some interesting kind of things, which we haven't talked much about. But, you know, in Anchorage right now, you can get Spam Musubi anywhere, right?
Yes.
A lot of different places. And one other vector in our food culture are different waves of immigration.
Sure.
You know, one that comes to mind in particular is the Filipino community, which has been, you know, was sort of intertwined with mining, fishing, the railroad, all kinds of things over time. And so I just wonder, are you hearing much from immigrant communities, especially ones that have long, deep historic roots, about important recipes? Or also, and also fusion. Another community that I think a lot about is the Korean community, which, you know, like it's very, very common in rural Alaska when you're eating muktuk to eat it with kimchi.
Kimchi, yeah.
But I don't know, you know, have any of those things come up?
Not yet.
So I was talking with a woman who's actually a chef here in town, and she's third generation Korean. And if she's listening, I hope she hears this, because I just reached out to her again to get her third generation with her touch on it, her kimchi recipe. I'm pretty sure it's kimchi, but just being third generation Korean and being a chef now here in town has to have some amazing A, story, B, things that she's working with that come from her background, her culture, her home culture. Which is very, you know, when you take that immigrant community, and that's the one we're trying to get into. So if anyone's listening and has Filipino connections, we'd love to. Hmong. You know, the Hispanic community. But it is definitely the sort of thing that we talk to a lot of people, but trying to get the recipes and the stories back is the hard part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has been the hard
and
part.
And like Lori said, the story is part of what our goal is. We're not making just a straight cookbook. We do want it to reflect all the different voices.
And we don't want to leave anybody out.
Yeah, we want to hear their story.
What's your story? Tell us.
And come, join us at the table.
Yes.
Well, it's a little bit tough to, you know, reach out to lots of different communities, especially ones that aren't connected to you personally. It takes a look. And I wonder, you know, if you guys have learned anything in that regard, just how it is to find people outside of your circle who have a different point of view.
Well, generally, I think the response has been really good. People think it's a great idea and they want to participate, or they immediately say, oh my gosh, I know somebody you should talk to. But then kind of getting that follow through, and something that has been a challenge for us is to go back and do some gentle reminding and, hey, did you have something for us? And again, everyone, you know, so far, everyone's come back and said, yes, I'm working on it right now. I'll get it to you. So we are looking for a number of 100 recipes by October, I think is what, and we're about a third of the way there. So recipes and stories.
Another thing I was thinking about is just that recipes are gendered. Often, you know, especially, you know, before, you know, we had women's pages in the newspaper up until like the 1970s, and that's where recipes lived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now it's much more common for men to be in the kitchen and that kind of thing. But I wondered if you've learned much about women's lives when you've been collecting these recipes, especially, you know, earlier in the
I don't think
century.
It was easy. I mean, I shared the blueberry cake. They were in Nanana, and, you know, when she needed to chill it, if it was fall or winter, she put it outside. How many of us have used our outdoors as a freezer in the winter time? Well, most all of us.
Call it my walk-in.
Absolutely.
Or your walk-out.
My walk-out.
Yeah, your walk-out. And so I think that it was easy. I mean, one of the recipes family from 1923 in Juneau, and through a variety of things that happened to the family, they ended up moving to Anchorage, and this woman, May, fell in love with a dashing young pilot who I'm pretty sure gave my dad his check ride back in the day when my dad got his pilot's license in small town. Anyway, and so even though this woman's childhood was spent a good deal of it in the Baranoff Hotel, because on the top were three penthouses and the family had one of them, and so she didn't have to learn to cook or clean or do anything, so she was kind of that way. And she the note was that dad loved to joke that she didn't even know how to boil water, but she had found her culinary stride in comfort food, especially casseroles, and she had a great sweet tooth. So what we have is that chocolate cake recipe, which the granddaughter makes to this day. So I think that there were lots of tragedies in women's lives and family lives, when lost children and things, and earthquakes and things that, you know,
husbands that
eruption.
Went down in plane crashes seems
Absolutely.
To be a theme.
Yeah. So, or
but I was
going to
mention, Karen, the dilly pea recipe from your mother's hairdresser shop in the 60s that I still use, that you gave me like 20 years ago.
It's the best.
It's a great recipe. But the hairdresser, that was where they exchanged things and apparently recipes.
It's a real window into, you know, kind of an unstudied part of our culture. I wanted to just talk about the actual physical project. Like, how will you test the recipes? Does it matter if they're good? Or do they exist kind of as artifacts just as they are?
I want to say both. Not all recipes are good, of course. But it's also the person that's testing them and tasting them. I mean, and we don't all have the same palate. So we will test some. We want to take some pictures in some kitchens. And we're going to do a disclaimer at the back that, you know, they haven't all been tested, but they're, you know, family stories. And they tell a tale of Alaska and what it was like to live, what it is like to live here, and what it was like to live here. And for people that walked across the Bering Land Bridge and moved on down the state and brought their cooking styles and hunter-gatherers with them. It's ambitious, and we'll see how it winnows down. I suspect it'll be organized regionally. And then we'll probably do a cross-reference if you're looking for desserts. Look, you know,
different indices in the back.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess, like, just my last question is just, is there this dilly recipe, what's your favorite recipe so far?
Well, there's a duck recipe here that's quite gourmet.
Actually, we need to make it quite quick because we're running into the end of the show.
Yes, we have them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
I just wanted to give a quick shout out to the editor of the show, Annie Fight, engineer Chris Hyde, producer Madeline Rose, and Sam Lang on the phones. Thank you very much for joining us today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.